Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. It's the day we talk about the management of acute myeloid leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes with Dr. Richard Stone, the Chief of Staff of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston. We have a great faculty. This is actually the last webinar in this series. And later on, we'll show you the results of a survey we did of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by Dr. Stone, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. In the chat room, you'll find a one-minute survey. If you could take that, and after the meeting, take it again, we would really appreciate it so we can learn a little bit more about you and what you're getting out of this. This is actually our last webinar of the year. We'll be starting back up in the beginning of the year, talking about ovarian cancer with Dr. Monk, and then we'll be heading out to San Francisco, doing two programs there in the GI Cancer Symposium. If you're in San Francisco, come on over and check it out. Otherwise, we'll be online at those times. And then on Saturday, January 20th, we'll be doing another program on hepatobiliary cancers that'll be virtual. We're also heading out in January to the GU Cancer Symposium, doing two programs there on prostate and bladder cancer. And next March, we're bringing back our weekend for general medical oncologists, working with a Florida cancer specialist in our hometown of Miami. We'll spend the whole weekend working with more than 25 investigators on a variety of tumors. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs, including our webinars. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. McHale on myeloma. So here we're going to talk about AML and MDS, and particularly, obviously, it's been a week now since the ASH meeting. That's always the big highlight of the year in general for hematologic cancers. So we want to comment a little bit about that. I just learned a few really cool things just chatting with Dr. Stone before we got started. We will be talking about unapproved indications and new agents today. We're really focused on the science of risk and benefits. And as we do in many of our programs, we're going to present real cases from practices, both from general medical oncologists and investigators. And so grateful to these docs for sharing their care with us and telling us about those patients. So we're good. Here's where we're heading. We're going to talk a little bit about ASH in the beginning, and we'll talk about it as we go through the meeting. Then we'll go through the cases, and finally, we'll pick up on the investigator survey that we did of their usual treatment practices. So we pulled a few papers that look pretty interesting, Rich, but you actually just told me about one that I missed that I really am curious to hear about. But first, in the realm of FLT3, which of course you have done so much work in, particularly related to the use of midostaurin and FLT3 inhibition. So I was curious what you thought about these two updates to the Quantum First trial looking at crizartinib. This is one looking at MRD. Any thoughts about what they reported here? And maybe just kind of remind the audience of what the study looked at and found in the primary report.
Sure. So the Quantum First trial was a very important trial in AML. It was designed similarly to the RATIFY trial, which was the trial that showed that adding midostaurin to chemotherapy in patients with mutant FLT3, that is FLT3 both with an internal tandem duplication and or a tyrosine kinase domain mutation, could benefit from the addition of midostaurin. There was an overall survival benefit in that RATIFY trial that led to the approval of midostaurin in that situation. The Quantum First trial was designed similarly, except that instead of midostaurin as the active agent, crizartinib, which is really a more selective and specific FLT3 inhibitor, better tolerated from a GI standpoint, maybe a little bit more myelosuppressive than midostaurin, was tested against placebo in combination with chemotherapy, both in induction and in consolidation, and in this case, post-transplant, if a patient had a transplant. Important things to remember that are different from the RATIFY trial and the Quantum First trial was, number one, because of the specificity of quizartinib, patients with a tyrosine kinase domain mutation, which is about 25% of all FLT3 mutations, were not eligible due to the fact that the quizartinib doesn't inhibit that type of mutation. Number two, the trial allowed patients up to age 70 to go on, so it was an older patient population. And number three, the use of transplant by the time this trial was undertaken was more common in first remission. And the results of the trial were actually quite similar to those of the ratified trial in that there was a significant hazard ratio of about 0.77 in favor of receipt of quizartinib compared to placebo in those with FLT3-ITD mutant AML. And it was pretty well tolerated. There was concerns about a QT prolongation signal that wasn't really seen. It was perhaps a bit myelosuppressive, but there weren't really any excess infectious deaths in the quizartinib arm. And this led to the approval of quizartinib to be given with chemotherapy in the induction and consolidation setting, although just like was ratify, the drug was not approved to be given in the maintenance setting because of the lack of a 2x2 design, which was the same criticism the FDA had for the ratify trial. So I think in that respect, it was a practice-changing trial. And of course, now people are going to wonder whether one should use quizartinib or midostaurin. I think quizartinib is slightly better tolerated from a GI standpoint. And so it may be the treatment of choice going forward, although that remains to be seen. There's no head-to-head comparison, but it was a very important trial.
How about this paper that followed up on that, looking at MRD, and then there was the other paper looking by treatment phase in terms of safety. So first of all, the MRD part.
Well, so the MRD part sort of showed what one would hoped it showed. Number one, that using a very sensitive MRD technique could determine which patient would do well. They showed quite clearly that if you were MRD positive, you did less well in either arm than if you were MRD negative. And the MRD test was using a sensitive FLT3 ITD detection by PCR followed by next generation sequencing. So it was a really neat technology that was highly prognostic. It was also predictive. Patients who benefited the most from the addition of quizartinib compared to placebo were those who were MRD positive at the time of initial assessment. This segues completely well with the results of the Morpho trial, which was using gilteritinib in the post-transplant setting. The patients who benefited the most from gilteritinib were those who had MRD-positive disease going into the transplant. So basically, these drugs are effective MRD erasers when you have FLT3-positive disease left over after chemotherapy. And further, it proved what appeared to be an obvious thing, which was that those who were randomized to quizartinib compared to placebo had a lower level of disease burden at the time of remission, indicating that indeed this did lead to deeper remissions, which probably accounted for the overall improved survival.
And what about the safety thing? The thing that I thought was interesting was that they kind of broke it down based on the phase as the patient would go through this. What's the sort of did this for a number of different tolerability issues. Can you kind of explain what this means, so to speak?
I think it means that the drug is well tolerated in every phase, that whether you're getting it in induction or consolidation or in maintenance, it's well tolerated, a little bit more myelosuppressive in maintenance, as you'd expect. But I think it just shows that it's a reasonable drug and safe in all the phases of treatment.
All right. Well, we talked about the big paper that was presented at ASH on luspatercept, and I want to get your take on that. But first, I want to show you a case of a patient who was treated, and I think also reflects, I think we're almost close to 4,000 cases we've been able to present since the beginning of the pandemic. And I just found it such an experience. Just even if in a minute, you get such a different view of the human aspect of the case. I love this one because I like the smile on Dr. Lee's face. Anyhow, here's the case.
So a 90-year-old, she was diagnosed with low-risk MDS due to anemia. She has dementia, lives at a nursing home. I started her on EPO unfortunately did not really respond. The nursing home kept on transferring to the hospital because of anemia. Eventually, I switched her to luspatercept, which was not easy to do because the nursing home was willing to give her the EPO. But obviously, nursing home cannot administer luspatercept. So I had to find a way to get her into the clinic. And I think most doctors in practice will tell you it is not easy to communicate with a nursing home to arrange for transportation to get them into the clinic. Half the time, transportation doesn't even pick them up. I started her on luspatercept. I did the dose escalation per the label, and her transfusion requirement has decreased. I think she's probably gone almost 2 months now without needing a transfusion. And so I'm so happy. It worked really well, exactly like what you think the drug should work like. And I'm hoping that she'll be transfusion independent soon. But this was one where it was a classic example of where ring sideroblasts and everything and no other cytopenias other than anemia. And so this very nice lady had a wonderful response. I wonder how investigators feel about using the drug in a frontline setting in RS negative disease.
So we'll take a look at the data before you answer the last question. But any thoughts about it? To me, is you know, it's not a high-tech, complicated issue here. You just stuck with it and, you know, really, I think, changed this woman's quality of life. Any thoughts?
Well, I think it is an advance, no question about it. You know, originally, the Medalist study showed that, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago, showed that luspatercept was superior to standard care or placebo in a group of MDS patients who either failed EPO or had very high EPO levels and had the expected biomarker for response, which is either ring sideroblasts or SF3B1 mutations with a low number of ring sideroblasts, like 5%. And it was a positive trial for transfusion independence with a pretty good side effect profile. And that led to this very exciting trial that Dr. Garcia Manero presented an update of at ASH, which was the COMMANDS trial, to see if maybe luspatercept would be superior to erythropoietin in newly diagnosed or non-previously treated low-risk MDS patients. And you can see from this slide that in all comers, this is the subgroup analysis, but in all comers, the primary endpoint, which is transfusion independence for 8 weeks, was met in all subgroups, whether their EPO level was high or low, whether they had an SF3B1 mutation or not. Although you can see in the next to the one on the right there, the greatest benefit was those who had SF3B1 mutations. And if you look to the one on the very right, you can see that the greatest benefit was the ones with the ring sideroblast. So I think in those who have the biomarkers that suggest response, luspatercept is a good drug to start with. Dr. Lee's patient did have the biomarker because they had ring sideroblasts. Yet, it's a little less clear to me whether people who don't have ring sideroblasts or an SF3B1 mutation really benefit more than erythropoietin. So I think we still need to look at these data in more detail in the non-RS, non-SF3B1 patients. But for those who have the biomarker, I think it's a great drug.
Yeah, it certainly is, and played out in this patient also. The other thing, there was some data presented on imeldostat also. Any thoughts about that? Let me see if I can find it, but maybe you can just comment on it.
Yeah, well, this is an amazing story. Imeldostat is a telomerase inhibitor. And one would think maybe when you don't think about it very much, that inhibiting telomerase would make your blood counts worse because you need that to maintain your genome. But it turns out that inhibiting telomerase in patients with MDS may be useful. And this eMERGE study was the phase 3 demonstration of that. I think it's a very important trial because it's probably going to lead to the approval of this drug, which is given intravenously every 4 weeks. And again, this was not all that different from the prior trial. Looking at your primary endpoint, again, 8 weeks of transfusion independence, which one could argue that's not a big deal, or it is a big deal, but the 24-week transfusion independence is a real thing. You can see that some patients in the placebo have 8 weeks of transfusion independence. That's because there's some inconsistency in what the hematocrits do in these people and what the transfusional patterns are. In any event, if you look at the 24-week transfusion independence, it was quite a bit different in favor of the imetelstat. So I think this drug is going to be licensed for use in low-risk patients. And maybe it'll be used, one can only guess, but maybe it'll be used preferentially in patients who aren't great candidates for luspatercept, then that is to say those who don't have an SF3B1 mutation or don't have ring sideroblast. But that's maybe over-interpretation of the data. Right now, we don't have any head-to-head comparison data of luspatercept to imetelstat. So I think it'll be a little bit of a therapeutic beauty contest when that imetelstat gets approved.
Well, the good news is patients are going to have more options. There'll be more people who are not going to be brought in for transfusions like this 90-year-old woman. So I also wanted to ask you, about magrolimab, where there was nothing at ASH 1, and I guess because it's maybe not going to be around very much anymore, but it seemed like a good idea. There were a couple of press releases related to that. It doesn't seem like there's much of a future. But any thoughts about the strategy? I mean, it seemed like it made a lot of sense. Are there other anti-CD47 agents out there being tested, or is this strategy sort of dead?
Well, Neil, this is such an instructive series of events in our field. So let's just start out with the hype and the excitement. When first of all, magrolimab potentially kills cells by a different mechanism than anything we've had before in this field. Rather than chemotherapy, it allows the macrophages to kill autologous blasts by covering up a don't eat me signal on the surface of the tumor cells. And if this works in MDS, it potentially could work in a lot of other tumors, because as this mechanism exists widely in cancer biology. That's number one. So it's a very interesting mechanism of action. And two, when it was combined with azacitidine in people with MDS, the response rate was high. And that's true for MDS and AML both, particularly in patients with the greatest unmet need. That is to say, patients with a P53 mutation who do miserably. I mean, it's just one of the most heartbreaking things to see somebody in clinic with a P53 mutation, especially if it's in a high VAF, if there's a biallelic loss, if there's a complex karyotype associated with it. This is a miserable patient who do terribly, and it's no better than metastatic pancreatic cancer. And so the response rates that were shown by Dr. Salmon and others combining HMA with magrolimab, this anti-CD47 drug, were very high, 70%. But over and over again in MDS, we must learn that response rates don't equate necessarily to overall survival. And that's particularly true in the P53 context. You can get the P53 clone to be suppressed, but you really can't get rid of it. And unfortunately, the phase 3 trial of azacitidine plus magrolimab and P53 mutant MDS, P53 mutant AML was negative, and the phase 3 trial of azaven versus azaven plus magrolimab in all comers is still being analyzed. There's some hope that'll be positive, but I think its use in P53 mutant AML was unfortunately overblown, and we need a completely new set of treatment paradigms for this subtype of AML. Do I think other CD47 drugs might have activity? It's possible, but obviously the failure of this drug to show a big benefit in this subset is very disappointing.
Very disappointing. We actually had a couple of investigators on a couple months ago who predicted boldly that it was the phase 3 trial. They were very confident that it was going to be positive, but unfortunately, as happens often in oncology too often, it didn't play out. A couple questions from the chat room. So Rosanna has a 40-year-old patient with hereditary sideroblastic anemia, hemoglobin of 4, needing transfusions every week, iron overloaded, plan to start luspatercept. Any experience in this setting? Also referred to for allo, incidentally, bone marrow, no MDS, no mutations.
That's a tough case, but I would strongly consider allogeneic stem cell transplant in this patient because of their young age and their need for long-term transfusional support with the possibility of iron overload. This is like a thalassemia patient who requires a lot of transfusions. So you definitely need to use iron chelation here to try to prevent iron overload. We know that patients that go into transplants with a high serum ferritin fare worse than those who have a low serum ferritin. That may be confounded by a lot of other things, but I'd be very concerned about this patient in the long term. Yeah, you could certainly try luspatercept. There's no data on hereditary sideroblastic anemia, which I'm aware of. It would be interesting to find out. But I think the major overwhelming theme here is the patient would need to be transplanted.
Another case from Anita. Do you think luspatercept would work in a patient with CMML who has some ring sideroblast, EPO less than 100, transfusion dependent, ESA refractory? And she notes that the NGS is ASXL1, SRSF2.
Yeah, that's a typical CMML patient's molecular profile, ASXL1, SRSF2. It's a particularly typical one for a non-proliferative CMML because the proliferative CMMLs tend to have RAS mutations. So it's kind of like a bifurcated disease. This is one of the more indolent patients, but one that might need a lot of transfusions as this does. So it's a great question, Anita, about whether or not luspatercept might have a role here. I wish I could tell you I thought it would have a high chance to work. However, if you look closely at the COMMANDS trial, patients who had splicing mutations, as this patient does with the SRSF2 mutation, other than the SF3B1, probably were the subgroup of patients, non-SF3B1 patients, who probably could benefit. So I think luspatercept is probably worth a shot here if you can get it paid for by the insurance company. That's a good thought, as it will be in myelofibrosis as well.
So we're going to go into another case of MDS, but first I want your thoughts about this paper that you were on looking at risk stratification. And just as I put that slide up, a question came up in the chat room that I think is related, but you can tell me. So this is from Thoy. Can you please comment on the new WHO criteria for MDS? Apparently, I was told by pathology recently, I'm just reading this, pathology recently that patients who don't have dysplasia in the marrow, but if they have TET2 mutations or other mutations, can now be called MDS. My patient only has severe neutropenia and a CF200. Patients in their 80s.
Yeah, I think the nomenclature, the classification for MDS has undergone some changes. It mainly has to do with the blast count. So there's two issues. One is classification, which is not discussed extensively in this paper, and the other is prognostic risk, which is probably more important. I mean, a rose made of the name would smell as sweet. What we really care about is how our patients are going to do. The pathologists need to look at the slides and the molecular data and the cytogenetic data and come up with a name for the disease. We clinicians like to know the name, but we also like to know how the patients are going to do, regardless of what we call it. So the new MDS classification system that is probably the most useful, at least based on statistics, is the IPSS-M classification system, which has largely supplanted the IPSS, the IPSSR, the WHO, and a number of other prior classification systems. But the stratification systems or prognostic systems, the classification systems are still in flux. There was a lot of consternation last year because of the development of two seemingly at odds classification systems, the ICC and the WHO. So the MDS defining mutations are not really MDS defining mutations, because if a person still requires dysplasia to be called MDS, there's something called CCUS or clonal cytopenias of uncertain significance. That's when you don't have enough dysplasia to call something MDS, but you still have these clonal abnormalities. They behave very similarly to lower risk MDS. So I think I would stick more closely to the prognostic scoring systems like the IPSSM and not worry too much about the nomenclature systems like the controversy between WHO and ICC, if you can do that.
That's a great input. Interesting, too. What about this paper you put out? I wanted you to comment on it because I really love this graphic in terms, I don't want you to go through the whole thing, but just so the audience knows about the paper. But what were the basic concepts that you were trying to get across in the paper?
Well, basically that the there's two different diseases here in writ large. The high-risk MDS, which really really behave more like leukemia. In fact, that's, to circle back to what I just said, the ICC at least admitted this by calling people with 10 to 19% blasts AML-MDS overlap. So the actual high-risk MDS category may be shrinking a bit because those with 10 to 19% blasts could be considered AML anyway. But those with excess blasts, which make up the most patients with high-risk MDS, should get DNA mutation, DNA methyltransferase inhibitor therapy with or without transplant. And everybody else has to get their cytopenias fixed. And this algorithm here is a way to look at that. We segregate people by their EPO level and by their SF3B1 mutation. And this is going to change next year when luspatercept comes, when imetelstat comes down the pike.
I think
you'll probably find that the third box there, the non-5Q minus SF3B1 wild type, may be getting imetelstat preferentially.
Interesting. Incidentally, any tolerability issues with imetelstat?
It can be somewhat mild suppressive, but generally is well tolerated.
All right, another case of MDS, a 63-year-old African-American woman, a patient of Dr. Malik.
She has a lot of social barriers getting back and forth into the clinic. There was also compliance issues with her. Unfortunately, she also, I think, has some mild MMR, just a little mental slowing, and she doesn't have a lot of help at home. So I think this would be the best way for her to get this treatment. She has a new type of insurance that's called a dedicated senior plan, where they have the primary carers involved in their care, where they can go out to the patient's homes. So I worked with that physician to make sure that she was able to take these medications. And then they wouldn't have to set up like Uber rides to our office 5 days a week. My first question was, what is cetazuridine? And from what I learned about it was that that's more of the drug to help eliminate decitabine through the oral route, from what I remember. And then what side effects? Is it similar to the IV or the sub-Q version or the IV version to the oral, or am I going to see more GI toxicity because it's an oral agent? Is it, you know, diarrhea? Coming in 5 days a week, no matter where you live, this is much easier for them. She's been doing well, so I would consider this as a preferred line.
Well, Hannah, that's a great story and really brings up, I think, something we often miss, which is the social determinants of health. Number one, there's good data years ago from MD Anderson that the comorbid diseases and the social situation of the patient actually is more important or as important as the biological nature of their MDS itself. These are indolent diseases, and where the patient lives, who they live with, what the supports are very important, as Hannah's discussion of this patient shows. So I think we always have to think about that very strongly when we care for the patients, number one. Number two, if this patient really has high-risk DEL5Q minus MDS, depending on how many blasts she has, she might be a candidate for lenalidomide therapy, although lenalidomide therapy is really designed for people that have low-risk disease. To take up the issue of the decitabine cetazuridine, yes, this is a combined pill, which cetazuridine, as Dr. Malik suggested, is a cytidine deaminase inhibitor. It prevents the detoxification of decitabine in the gut, so it doesn't get metabolized to an inactive metabolite in the gut brush border, and it can be given orally. It is equivalent to IV decitabine, as shown by a trial done by Garcia Monero, where there was bioequivalence of IV decitabine to this decitabine cetazuridine combo pill. But this patient would probably bring up the major problem with this agent. It's not more toxic, by the way, than decitabine. Maybe a little bit more mild suppressive, hard to tell. The comparative trial showed that they were the same, IV decitabine and this pill. But the problem is, ironically enough, is the money. Because this pill is extremely expensive. The copays tend to be very high, and it's actually cheaper for patients in most cases to get IV decitabine or IV azacitidine in the clinic compared to taking this at home. I have a patient that I just admitted to the hospital. She was on this pill a while back. She was able to spend the $3,000 a month because she lives in a ritzy part of Massachusetts that where she got this drug because her copay was $3,000 a month. And that's just not going to be possible for a lot of patients. Yeah, there's copay assistance. But once the price comes down or if people can get it, I agree with Hannah. It's going to be a big boon compared to having to come into the clinic 5 days a week. But it works the
same. Virgilia, yeah, it seemed, you know, the BTK inhibitors and venetoclax and everything else are very expensive for CLL, and it seems like somehow they are able to get it. I wonder whether or not that was happening in terms of this agent. Virgilio in the chat room wants to know whether or not you can use oral decitabine with venetoclax.
That's a great question. And I think we ironically have an abstract that, or there was an abstract presented by the MD Anderson group where they did just that. And it seemed to be well tolerated, had the same side effect profile as IV or sub-Q Aza plus oral venetoclax. So I do think that we will be working toward an all-oral therapy for lots of patients with AML and MDS once the trial shows that Ven plus Aza is better than Aza in MDS. So right now we know that Ven plus Aza is better than Aza in AML. And so I think as people get more familiar with this oral agent and show that it can be combined safely with venetoclax, I do think you will have an all-oral regimen for AML.
So let's go back to FLT3. Before we get started on that, you were mentioning to me before some of the data, I think you said it started to come out in EHA, on the possibility that quizartinib might have an effect on FLT3 wild-type patients?
Yeah, this is an amazing story. So going back to midostaurin for a second, just to put it in context, when midostaurin was originally tested as a single agent, there were some responses in FLT3 wild-type patients. And people thought that was because midostaurin was a very pleiotropically active drug and may have hit other targets. On that basis, there was a trial called UNIFY that was mounted in FLT3 wild-type patients. Was 3 and 7 plus midostaurin versus 3 and 7 plus placebo in FLT3 wild-type patients. It was completely negative. So midostaurin was a bust in that setting. But this Kiwi trial that you referred to was done in FLT3 wild-type patients also. And it was 3 and 7 plus quizartinib versus 3 and 7 plus placebo. And it's a very specific FLT3 inhibitor. So when I first heard about this, I said, it's never going to work. Why would it work in FLT3 wild-type patients with a very specific FLT3 inhibitor? It turns out it was a positive trial, at least for overall survival. And there was a trend toward an improvement in event-free survival. So that was presented at EHA. And then there was an ancillary trial presented at ASH. Of course, the phase 3 trial I referred to was only done in Spain. But anyway, a Spanish investigator presented the data looking at the RNA expression pattern of patients on the trial and showed that a bunch of patients had a FLT3-like expression pattern, which means that their RNA expression in their cells was the same as you get with a bona fide FLT3 mutant patient. And we don't know yet if those were the patients that benefited, but that's a reasonable hypothesis. In other words, there were a bunch of patients with FLT3 wild-type disease that behave like FLT3 ITD patients. And maybe that's those are the guys that get benefited by quizartinib and accounted for the positive outcome in that trial. There's going to be a confirmatory trial done more worldwide, sponsored by the company, that I think will be very important in this novel field.
And the good part, really good part, is you said it's about 50% of FLT3 wild type has this RNA signature
expression. Yeah, it's 50%. Very similar. Yeah. I think it was, and it's very similar in concept to the notion of Philadelphia-like ALL, where a bunch of patients right. don't have a Philadelphia chromosome still behave like they have a Philadelphia chromosome physiologically. It's better than that, actually, because those Philadelphia-like ALL patients don't all benefit from a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, not the ones we use for CLL, for CML anyway. But in this case, it seems like these patients do all benefit from a FLT3 inhibitor. but we don't know that for certain yet.
Sounds super exciting. Well, anyhow, let's get back to FLT3 today because I've got a couple cases for you, beginning with a 69-year-old man with a FLT3 ITD mutation. This is a patient of Dr. Olin's.
So this is a 69-year-old gentleman. He has a history of obesity, diabetes, atrial fibrillation, and also a history of prostate cancer. Presented to his primary care doctor with subacute fatigue, and he was found to have myelodysplastic syndrome with 4% blasts. And at that time, he was treated with transfusions and growth factors. I first met him when he presented for a second opinion 2 months later. His white count was found to be 104,000 with greater than 50% blasts, hemoglobin in the sixes and platelets of 16. His bone marrow biopsy was 95% cellular with 60% myeloid blasts. And given his history of radiation for prostate cancer, this also was classified as a therapy-related AML. Cytogenetics and AML FISH panel were normal, and his molecular genetics were notable for a FLT3 ITD with an allelic ratio of 0.59. He also had mutations in RUNX1, SF3B1, and WT1. So this patient was treated with 7 days of azacitidine in combination with venetoclax, but I do wonder whether any panelists might have chosen a FLT3 inhibitor as part of his upfront therapy, knowing that he was FLT3 positive. I wonder if anyone might have chosen 7+3+ midostaurin as well. In this case, the patient did have a lot of comorbidities.
Did you consider him eligible to receive intensive therapy?
I think in his case, it was a borderline call. I'm interested to know how much weight people give to comorbidities and how they assess a list of comorbidities.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great and typical case. So when I see a patient like that, just like Dr. Olin, I would assess the patient's fitness for chemotherapy and likelihood of responding to non-traditional therapies. This patient might have been eligible for the VIALE-A trial, although they were under age 75. They had significant comorbidities. And it turns out that we showed in an abstract we presented that patients with the MDS type mutations, this patient had one, I think it was SRSF2 or one of the splicing mutations, seemed to benefit from azacitidine and venetoclax. So I like the idea of giving this patient non-3 and 7 therapy, number one. The question that Rebecca, because of the age close to 75, the comorbidities, the treatment-related phenomenon, so azaven is completely reasonable based on the VIALE-A trial. The question is whether adding a FLT3 inhibitor. There was a trial that compared gilteritinib plus azacitidine to azacitidine alone. That was a negative trial that Eunice Wong presented a couple of years ago. But there's data from a triplet uncontrolled trial presented by Nick Short of MD Anderson, soon to be published, of azacitidine plus gilteritinib plus venetoclax in people that are older or unfit for chemo, that has a very high response rate in untreated patients, 100%. That's pretty high. The durability remains to be seen. But I think you could, even though it's not controlled data, you can make a strong case for giving triplet therapy to a patient like this. But I want to emphasize that giving azaven is not wrong. Giving 3 and 7 plus quizartinib or 3 and 7 plus midostaurin is not wrong. So this is where the judgment comes in because, you know, you've got the patient before you. I presume that the folks who treated this patient didn't think he could tolerate 3 and 7 chemo, and giving azaven was reasonable. I might have strongly considered azaven gilteritinib.
I'm not sure we're going to get to the survey very much, but the audience can check it out in the chat room. We went through it in prior meetings. I want to make sure we get through these cases. But one thing we did ask is, in general, what's your preference for a FLT3 inhibitor and somebody who's, with an ITD who's eligible to receive either quiz or midostaurin right now?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the patient. My own view is that if they have increased risk of myelosuppression for whatever reason, I might consider midostaurin. But I think quizartinib is probably a slightly better drug. So once it becomes widely available, it isn't yet at my place, but once it becomes available, I think it would be the treatment of choice for those who have ITDs. For those who have TKDs in the FLT3 gene, they have to get midostaurin because the quizartinib doesn't hit that mutation.
When you say better, do you mean better tolerated or also better efficacy?
I'm mainly talking about better efficacy. I actually think the tolerance is similar. And I think, because one has more GI toxicity, i.e. midostaurin, one has more myelosuppressive toxicity, i.e. quizartinib. So it's kind of a wash in that respect. I think it's slightly better because if you look at just the people that are under age 60, which is comparable, if you throw out all the older people in the quantum first trial, they weren't included in the ratified trial. I think the quizartinib looks a little bit better. So, I mean, if you make me pick, I would pick quizartinib. I don't think it makes a whole bunch of difference, frankly.
Okay, here's another case of FLT3, a 73-year-old woman who'd previously been treated for inflammatory breast cancer, actually HER2-positive disease, and did really well after that, but unfortunately then developed AML. Here's the case.
In 2020, I saw her when I was on call when she presented to the hospital with significant fatigue and leukocytosis. Lab showed a white count of 48,000, and a subsequent bone marrow biopsy confirmed acute myeloid leukemia with 65% blast. FLT3 ITD was detected. I started her on venetoclax and azacitidine, and after two cycles, she achieved a complete response. She then underwent a non-ablative allogeneic transplant followed by gilteritinib maintenance for 2 years.
What made you decide to give her venetoclax and azacitidine?
I thought because of all of the adjuvant chemo she received, I didn't feel comfortable giving her an anthracycline. And this was at the beginning of COVID as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, we were not trying to put patients in the hospital for any reason.
Any thoughts?
I think that's a great approach. Obviously, the patient's done well. It's interesting, in the VIALE-A trial, those patients got azacitidine venetoclax. They weren't supposed to be transplant candidates. But wink, wink, after they got the azacitidine and they responded like this patient did, they often became transplant candidates because they got better from their leukemia. And you could actually benefit from a transplant as this patient did. So I think this was managed brilliantly. We don't have the randomized data in a patient like this to justify or to say that azacitidine is better than 3 and 7. My gut feeling is it will turn out to be as good and less toxic, but that remains to be proven by a series of trials which are going on now. I think the gilteritinib maintenance post-transplant is a very interesting question. Mark Levis addressed this in the so-called Morpho trial, which was a trial of patients who were FLT3 ITD positive at diagnosis. They got some therapy, then they went to transplant, and they were randomized to nothing or to gilteritinib maintenance post-transplant. And it took a lot of patients to show gilteritinib was possibly superior to no maintenance. Actually, the trial did not meet its primary endpoint, as the event-free survival was the same. But if you looked at just patients who were had MRD-positive FLT3 disease, those are the ones that benefited from the maintenance. So a patient like this right now would probably go on maintenance therapy if they still had MRD positive disease before the, after the initial therapy.
So before we go into the next case, I was just flashing on the fact that a lot of times in the chat room, people put trade names. I have no idea what they're even, I have to look it up. That's how bad I am at trade names nowadays.
Good for you.
I literally don't know them. All right, so now let's go to a younger patient, 35-year-old man, very interesting case from Dr. Halpern.
This is a very fit man. He presented with back pain, and an x-ray and the CT spine showed a T11 pathologic fracture with lytic soft tissue destruction and extension into posterior bony elements. He had a laminectomy and a spinal fusion to stabilize the fracture, decompression and resection of epidural tumor, and pathology was consistent with myeloid sarcoma. He did receive chemotherapy with CLAG-M and went into a complete remission, and PET showed resolution of his disease. He received consolidation times one cycle with HIDAC and went on to receive an allogeneic stem cell transplant from a matched unrelated donor. He did receive myeloablative conditioning as he was young and fit. My question for the panel is, are these patients typically someone that you would try to get to transplant, even without other adverse risk markers, such as adverse mutations in cytogenetics? You know, transplant is not great at extramedullary disease. The graft versus leukemia effect is not as successful. And then my other question is, you know, historically, we know these are sensitive to high-dose cytarabine, but are people using azacitidine venetoclax in extramedullary disease? My understanding is that some are, and any evidence or success with the use of venetoclax. This patient is young and was a candidate for intensive chemotherapy, but if the patient had been older, would an HMA venetoclax strategy have been appropriate?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of questions embedded in there, but they're all good. So the use of intensive chemotherapy in a patient with extramedullary disease is probably standard of care. We don't really have much data with azaven in those patients. So if you have to, if the patient's unfit for standard chemo and you have to use azaven, I would, that's fine. But in general, I would try to use standard chemo. And I like the high dose ARC because that gets into areas that aren't reached by the, you know, by normal doses of chemotherapy. So I like the way this patient was treated. Obviously, they've done well. We still believe strongly that you can't cure a patient like this without a transplant. Extramedullary disease in and of itself is a bad prognostic sign. And I think the decision to transplant this patient was quite reasonable. I'm not even sure what the consolidation achieved here. I would take them right to transplant. And the fact that they've done well is a great sign.
So speaking of TP53, here's an 85-year-old man who's a patient of a general medical oncologist, Dr. Neil Morgenstein in Summit, New Jersey.
So this is an 85-year-old met just about 3 months ago who presented with rapidly declining blood counts. He had a bone marrow biopsy done right away, which showed a MDS with excess blast 2. I believe he had about 17% blast. He had one of these ridiculously long, complicated cytogenetics where it goes on to the third line. And on next-generation sequencing, he had a TP53 mutation. He was just admitted for azacitidine for 7 days and venetoclax, and he was just discharged from the hospital. He's still requiring transfusion support. He's still quite cytopenic. So again, this is a very active case. I mean, he just left the hospital. I guess I'd like to know, what are the expectations for this patient? I mean, he's a good 85-year-old, or was a good 85-year-old, but if somebody was to counsel him about what's the likelihood of him living 6 months, a year, or going into a remission, what would be a fair conversation to have with him? And then, you know, again, we don't see these that often. So what is the optimal dose and what is the optimal schedule of the HMA and which is the best HMA to give, whether it's decitabine or azacitidine? And then can we switch these guys to oral azacitidine when they leave the hospital?
Well, all good questions, Neil. I must say that a lot of these are in the vein of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic because, unfortunately, this is the worst of the worst. The complex karyotype with a high variant allele frequency, P53 mutation, are different animals than the rest of the stuff we treat. These people do not respond to chemotherapy, period. I would not use venetoclax in a patient like this because we and others have shown that adding venetoclax in P53 mutant AML is not worth it. You just myelosuppress them more and it doesn't help. We're not the only people that show this. Dr. Doner showed it last year at ASH. Dan Pollier showed it. We reviewed our data and showed it in a presentation done by my colleague, Dr. Shimoni. So, you know, it just doesn't work. So I don't give venetoclax to these patients anymore, period. Azacitidine might help them temporarily. The median survival is 6 months or less. I think you have to be honest with the families about what your expectations might be and not over-treat them in the hopes that they're going to have some kind of a response. In a young person, I would treat them aggressively in the hopes we can get them to a transplant. But an 85-year-old, I would either not treat them treat them with one cycle of azacitidine or something to see how they tolerate it, but they're not going to do well. It's a terrible case. You know, you can switch them to oral decitabine. You can reduce the dose, increase the dose. It's not going to make any difference. I think a frank discussion with a patient and their family is what's required, and a clinical trial, if there's one available, is what's required here, not more old drugs.
So let's go into another case. This is a patient who also got HMA venetoclax, but did well, a 70-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Kariakis.
The patient had poor performance status, ECOG of 2, poor cytogenetics, and poor risk disease. She was not a candidate for intensive chemotherapy. Next-generation sequencing came back with no targetable mutation, so I actually started the patient on HMA and venetoclax. What do you do with venetoclax interaction with the azole inhibitors? Because all of these patients, they will need fungal prophylaxis. For my patient, I started her on HMA with venetoclax, and I usually start with 50, 100, and then I max the dose at 200 milligrams with fluconazole. The patient completed 1 month of treatment. At day 30 bone marrow biopsy, the patient was still cytopenic, so I repeated the marrow, and she had hypoplastic marrow, no evidence of disease. What do you do for those patients who achieved a morphological remission and a marrow aplasia, but they have not still recovered their counts? At which point would you use growth factors in these patients? So I actually stopped the treatment for about 2 weeks, waited for count recovery, and then I put the patient on a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off schedule.
And then what happened?
The patient right now, she's about 6 months on treatment, and she is still maintaining complete remission status. Transplant would be really very tough for her, so I would not consider transplanting this patient. My question is, if a patient who is poor cytogenetics or they're P53 mutated, would you consider venetoclax with 7 and 3, or would you consider venetoclax with HMA?
So there's a lot of questions there, Dr. Kariakis. I think, again, I'll repeat what I said about if they really have complex karyotype P53 mutant disease, I would not intensify therapy. I don't think that's going to help, and I would use azacitidine alone. You know, in a young patient, maybe I would give chemo just to give them the benefit of the doubt, although I don't think it's going to work. Older patient, definitely azacitidine alone. You don't want to make things worse. I think doing what you made a very important point about doing marrows when a patient's cytopenic after azaven, that's very important to do that. And one should hold the therapy until the cytopenia recovers. And in terms of using growth factors, we don't use much growth factors at Dana-Farber, although there are other centers like MD Anderson where they do. I don't have any problem in using growth factors. But frankly, if you use them when they're already cytopenic, if the horse is out of the barn a little bit, it's a little too late. You can try them to see if they make the counts better. So cosmetically, you'll feel better about giving them another cycle. But I think, again, to repeat, for the intensive therapy patients, I don't use intensive therapy for P53 patients. I do bone marrows when there's cytopenias after HMA-VEN, and I keep giving the HMA-VEN indefinitely, although Dr. Love may show some data about possibly being able to stop it after a good response.
That was just what I was going to ask you about, because I thought this is a pretty cool paper. Kind of made me think about stopping venetoclax and CLL. But anyhow, can you talk about what they did here?
Yeah, very simply that they gave, on the bottom, they gave people azaven indefinitely, which is the current standard of care. Whereas in the top, they stopped it. And they had a very good treatment for intervals. You can see there's very little, the black stuff is when they stopped it there, and then the lighter bars are when the patient was still around getting it. You can see a lot of those patients are still alive after long remissions. So I think this is a similar thought, if you will, to the CML story. We can stop a tyrosine kinase inhibitor if there's a good response and the patient's been on it for a long time. So this, if it's confirmed, this study could really change the way we look at our older patients and maybe stop giving them continuous azaven, which can be quite difficult from a patient care standpoint, from a research standpoint, from a financial standpoint. So this is potentially going to be a very important study if it's confirmed in larger groups.
Any comments on this paper looking at, I think we brought up the issue of bringing venetoclax in with intensive chemo.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in venetoclax intensive chemo. We're doing a Ven plus 3 and 7 trial right here at Dana-Farber. Dr. DiNardo's presented Flag, Ida, Ven. Dr. Chua and Dr. Wei from Australia presented 2 plus 5 plus Ven. This trial that you showed from China is a similar. I think in chemo-responsive patients, adding Ven is going to deepen the responses. So I do think someday when the randomized trials are done, I predict that Ven plus chemo will be the way to go.
Interesting. So one more case. This is back to Dr. Halpern, a 70-year-old man who initially was treated with Aza-Ven and responded and then progressed. Here's what happened.
A bone marrow biopsy showed recurrence of his AML at 8% blasts. NGS was repeated, no new mutations. He still had his IDH1. And so he was transitioned to single agent ivosidenib. His blood counts improved. A bone marrow biopsy after 4 cycles showed CR. And he remains in CR many years later. I think we're over 3 years on the ivosidenib. And he is doing fantastically. And he has a lot of comorbidities he's dealing with. And I don't know if that is going to be what ultimately gets him, but it's a very, very long response to ivosidenib with normal blood counts and thus a good quality of life. And so I think the sort of discussion points here are sort of sequencing on venetoclax and ivosidenib in an older patient. My question would be to the panel, would anyone use a triplet, aza-ven-ivosidenib in this? I wouldn't in this older patient, first because of toxicities, but also because, you know, that all my eggs are in one basket. And then would they have chosen aza-ven up front if both were available, aza-ivosidenib up front or single agent ivosidenib up front?
Yeah, great question. I mean, the short answer is there's data supporting both aza-ven in these patients, and there's data because that's a very effective combo for the IDH1 mutant patients, and there's great data supporting ivosidenib and azacitidine in these patients, but from the AGILE trial. There's also emerging data from a triplets with aza-ven plus ivo with 100% response rate. We've been doing that here in conjunction with Dr. DiNardo at MD Anderson. I do think the future will be triplets in the targeted patients because aza-ven is a good backbone and you're going to add your best backbone to your best targeted agent. So I think you'll see aza-ven ivo, aza-ven anacetinib, aza-ven gilteritinib as emerging therapies for the older adults that are unfit for chemo. And my bold prediction is that you'll even see those being used in younger adults someday because I think they'll be very effective.
Any thoughts about why patients with IDH seem to respond so well to aza-ven?
There is some data from Ravi Majeti in Stanford about the physiology of cells that have IDH mutations having to do with their mitochondrial sensitivity to venetoclax, a BCL2 inhibitor, that probably explains it or begins to explain it.
So one other thing I want to ask you about, and I've been hearing about menin inhibitors from you and your colleagues for a while. We saw a couple papers at ASCO on revumenib. I know you were involved with that. Can you just sort of summarize what the situation is and whether or not we're going to see this strategy approved in the next year or so?
Well, perhaps I'm biased, but I do think this is one of the most exciting things in AML to come out in the last few years because this is based on wonderful science done by many individuals, but one in particular, Scott Armstrong at our place, who showed that the transcriptional complex involving the protein menin is very important in at least two types of leukemia, those leukemias with an MLL rearrangement, usually that's in chromosome 11, or with an NPM1 mutation, which is kind of common. We talked about that earlier. And both those abnormalities lead to the overactivity of a bunch of genes in the so-called Hox-MEIS gene cluster. And menin inhibitors disrupt the protein-protein interaction, so it's a new class of drugs in that respect as well. There have been responses with menin inhibitors, particularly revumenib, which is the first one from the factory that works in both NPM1 mutant and MLL, now called KMT2 rearranged AML. So I think they have great activity for single agents in relapse disease, and they're being brought up front in combination with both low dose and high dose chemotherapy.
So, Rich, thanks so much for working with us again. Audience, thank you for attending this whole year. You know, Rich, we have the best chat room in the business. They come up with the best Quake cases and questions, and it's really a pleasure to work with them. And not to mention the many physicians who presented cases in our webinars this past year and over the last few years. Come on back on January 9th. We're ready to rock and roll again on ovarian cancer. Be safe, stay well, and have a great holiday season. Thanks so much, Rich.
Thank you. Very exciting.